This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tune in today as the aging but still powerful Lance Armstrong begins his epic struggle to win an unprecedented sixth Tour de France. Can Lance fight off the advances of fellow American Tyler Hamilton, better known as the man who rides fast even with a broken collarbone? Will German Jan Ullrich finally say enough is enough after coming in second five times, often to Lance himself? Or will it be the unpredictable Spaniard Iban Mayo and his wily ways on the Alpe d'Huez who offers Lance his most difficult challenge? And can any man concentrate on riding a bike when distracted by the beautiful and melodious Sheryl Crow? Bob Rolfe, four-time tour rider, Outdoor Life Network color commentator, and author of the Tour de France Companion, joins us to answer these questions, or at least some of them. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Most Americans think that two words, Lance and Armstrong, are about all they need to know about the Tour de France. Even with Armstrong's success, why have Americans been hesitant or perhaps unable to learn more about this race?
Well, it's a very old sport. It's pretty esoteric. There's a lot of rules, written and unwritten, that seem at first glance to be a little bit difficult. Mm-hmm. If you were from Mongolia and you were taken to a baseball game, you would have no idea what was going on. So it takes some real academic involvement.
Two questions that your answer suggests. One, is it worth it to make that investment of time and effort? And two, is it possible to really have an understanding without being there, standing on the course watching the racers go by?
The first question, I think, is pretty simple. It's the greatest race in the world, and there's all kinds of races. There's running races, automobile races, ski races, motorcycle races, but every single human characteristic that you can identify is put to the test at the Tour. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I think that the investment of time and energy into learning about it is very rewarding. And to get a full sense of it, it's nice to be there, but honestly, it's better when you watch it on TV, because if you're there on the course, you see the riders whiz by, you know, just for a moment. Each year, the Tour has more and more viewers as the gospel spreads. So if you have a couple of hours in the morning during July, I don't think you could find a much better way to spend it.
Gospel is an interesting word to use in that context.
For the fans of cycling, it does become religion and takes over your life watching the Tour. And even the hoopla beforehand is pretty frightening. The people that are converted to the sport, and especially in the United States when it's not one of our traditionally huge professional sports, it's a pretty dramatic conversion.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of the Tour. The inaugural race was six stages over 18 days, but stages took as many as 35 hours to complete, and competitors were hampered by unpaved roads in some cases, constant cigarette smoking to, quote, open the lungs, an interesting theory. And I understand that by the second race, the very second time they did this event, race riders and spectators basically were taking all sorts of measures to help out their favorites and slow down the guys they didn't like.
The riders took it upon themselves to reduce some of the difficulties by getting in trains, hopefully undetected. Everyone was disqualified, I think, down to the eighth place guy and who was awarded the second Tour crown. But in those days in France, you're talking almost like prehistory. Very few paved roads, very few hotels. The riders were not allowed any assistance, and at the turn of the century in the United States, even through the 20s and 30s, we had those marathon dance contests,
uh-huh.
And people dropped dead during those in the States, and people were gripped by a form of madness for a short period of time in human history, and the Tour de France is no exception to that.
There's one story in your book about a guy who the fork on his bike broke, and he stopped, carried the bike to a blacksmith shop, and fixed it himself. That was the only way he could continue, the only way he would be allowed to continue.
Yes, Eugene Christophe in the teens, his fork broke on the Tourmalet Pass. He had to run back down the pass 14 miles to the blacksmith shop, fix his fork, get back on his bike, and continue the race. Another 14 miles later, the fork broke again. He wasn't a very good welder.
Better rider than
he
welder.
He was a much better bike racer than welder, but believe me, any of the guys in the peloton today could not fix their bike. So
I'm sure.
He actually went on to found probably the most famous toe clips ever produced in the world, the Christoff toe clips. So he didn't do too bad in the long run.
We could not have any conversation about the Tour de France without spending some time talking about Lance Armstrong. For years, there's been controversy over whether his success is a result of doping, but you're on the record saying that his talents are natural. What leads you to that conviction?
Knowing him and then in the many long discussions and hours of talking, and one thing that people need to understand is that the stakes are a lot higher for Lance. You know, when you abuse drugs that aren't necessary, the health risks go up tremendously. And so Lance's stakes in that way are a lot different than anybody else because of his battle with cancer when he was still a very young man. So when I add up all of those things, I am 100% sure that Lance has never taken drugs to race bikes and never will. And as a professional myself, we won a lot of races without ever taking any drugs. So I know it can be done, and I know that the doping controls that are in place are the most far-reaching of any professional sport, and so it gives me utter confidence in presenting the sport of cycling as it should be, not as a doping spectacle, but as a sporting spectacle.
The Tour follows a different course every year, and I understand that it's a long-standing tradition to make the course each year as difficult as possible for the guy who's going to be the favorite in that year's race. How have race officials accomplished that task this time around?
This time they tried to reduce the advantage that the U.S. Postal team in the team time trial, which is each team of nine riders races against the clock by themselves. The gap between U.S. Postal and the Euskadi team, for example, that has a couple of really solid contenders last year as well as this year, was 4 minutes. That's a big deficit to carry into the first mountain stage. So the tour organizers have reduced the maximum deficit that any team will be assessed at 2.5 minutes. It will be a little bit more interesting the first couple of days in the mountains until the general classification starts to shake all of the pretenders out and elevate the real contenders to the top of the leaderboard.
I'm sure you're right that the race will be interesting in many respects, but let's skip to the end. Does Lance Armstrong win it again?
I think he does. I believe he will. It's funny because last year, since four other riders had already won five tours, Everyone assumed Lance would win. I mean, there was even no question about it. Because six has never been done, people don't believe it's possible, but I think he can win, yes.
Bob Rohl's new book is called The Tour de France Companion. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
In 1991, anyone wishing to be like Mike could allegedly do so by forking over the somewhat less than princely sum required to buy a liter of sports drink. By contrast, in 2004, cyclists can be like Lance for a slightly heftier price tag. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
At first glance, Trek's 2004 limited edition Lance Armstrong Madoni bike doesn't seem all that different from other high-end purchases at Landry's Bicycles in Westboro, Massachusetts. But considering that just last year this bike wasn't even available to the other members of Armstrong's U.S. Postal Service team, manager Mark Vautour says he's lucky to have one in his store.
Many times Lance gets stuff before the rest of the team gets it. So in this case, he had a frame that was a prototype frame that wasn't available to anybody else, and now it's available to the general public, which is pretty cool because in NASCAR, you couldn't go out and buy Jeff Gordon's car, but you can ride really anything the pros ride from any manufacturer. You can get your hands on it pretty reasonably, too.
That's true, if you consider $7,000 a reasonable price for a bicycle. If not, you can always buy the regular edition without the special yellow paint job, U.S. Postal Service seat, and Lance Armstrong autographed lithograph for about $2,000 less. Either way, Vautour says this is a sports collectible that should be put to use.
I would definitely ride it. Yeah, you wouldn't want to leave it in your garage and hang it on a wall and stare at it. It makes for great art, but on top of that, it's phenomenal machinery. One thing about carbon fiber that makes it different than steel and aluminum is it's phenomenally comfortable. It gives a very quiet ride, a very smooth and stable ride. To hang it on your wall and not ride it would be a shame.
Finding the opportunity to ride is generally not a problem for fans of the Tour. Travel agencies lead vacations to France, not just to see the Tour, but to ride its most difficult climbs. A Massachusetts brewery is organizing a 50-mile bike ride to launch its latest offering, Tyler's Clavic Ale, a reference to last year when hometown hero Tyler Hamilton finished the Tour in fourth, despite a broken collarbone. But not every fan of the Tour de France is intimately familiar with a bicycle seat.
People that watch the Tour aren't racers per se. They're people that join riding. Aren't necessarily the mountain climbers of the world and the bike racers, but people that are inspired by the story. It's really the toughest sporting event in the world. It covers something like 2,100 miles up and over the Alps and the Pyrenees. I don't put that many miles in my car in a month.
The Tour, with all its drama, beauty, and grandeur, has been around for more than 100 years. And for most of that time, Americans barely noticed. That might still be true, Vautour says, if it wasn't for Lance Armstrong and his personal struggle with cancer.
What Tiger Woods has done for golf, Lance has done for cycling. Especially not only do they bring more people in, it gets more people out riding. And the whole cancer story has brought a lot of people that never rode a bike since they were a kid back out on a bike for fitness reasons.
It's cycling as a fitness craze that's opened the high-end bike market to regular Joes. While you might think the person who's willing to drop $7,000 to be like Lance drives a flashy car, think again. Vautour says the man who bought number one in the limited series of 500 Lance Armstrong bicycles drives a Ford Taurus wagon. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Westboro, Massachusetts.
Here we are, both of us out on the wheel, happy as long as we go. Life is a mixture, but in it we feel better the wheel than the alone. There's never a road.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Picking surfing as the sport of choice can still give a muscled young man an advantage as far as shapely beauties are concerned, or at least that's true as regards one particularly shapely beauty. Eschewing the foppish tennis-playing Ken of her fatuous youth, Barbie has hooked up with Blaine, the exciting Australian surfer. Actually, the choice of Barbie's new boy toy was made by more than 2 million people who logged onto a website and voted for Blaine, who will be available in all his Hang Ten Shoot the Curl Out of My Way Mike glory for $14.95 next month. Ken, meanwhile, is reportedly exploring the possibility of resurrecting the senior men's tennis tour or hitting Blaine with his racket while the lucky winner's asleep. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Jeff Benedict, author of Out of Bounds, Inside the NBA's Culture of Rape, Violence, and Crime. But first, the Women's United Soccer Association abruptly suspended operations last September, to the dismay of the league's fans and, of course, its players. As Nick Roman reports, high spirits and uncertainty have prevailed this summer as the WUSA attempts to revive itself.
Maybe it was the sight of 100,000 fans packed into the Rose Bowl for the 1999 Women's World Cup final. Or knowing that millions and millions of American moms and dads spend Saturdays hauling ladybugs and green grasshoppers to soccer games. Whatever it was, the organizers of the WUSA, the Women's United Soccer Association, thought they had a winner when the league began play in 2001. Then, at the end of last summer, when fan interest in the 2003 Women's World Cup was ready to peak, the WUSA went silent.
The league was too busy trying to find ways to keep itself afloat money-wise, and kind of, and I'll say this, took its eye off the ball, so to speak.
Marketing consultant Michael Ritz joined the WUSA's front office only 11 weeks before the end. He says when the league began cutting costs almost from the beginning just to hang on, it cut back significantly on marketing and advertising budgets. That's a killer for a league trying to grab the attention of sports fans in a world dominated by baseball, basketball, and football. But Ritz spreads the blame around, too, to fans who were stunned when the WUSA suspended operations. He says the calls and emails poured in.
Hi, I'm a soccer dad. What am I going to tell my 11-year-old? Or, hi, I'm a 9-year-old and my dream is dead now. And sometimes we would have the opportunity to talk with these folks, and I would ask the question and say, so how many games did you go to when the New York Power was in existence or the Atlanta Beat was in existence? And people would sheepishly say, well, none. Or, well, I went to one in the first year. And I would look at them and say, well, gee, here you are telling me that this was the dream and the passion, and yet you didn't support the effort.
Ritz could have been talking to Steve Aguilar. His three daughters play soccer in Corona, California, and he's a coach. But he never took his family on the hour-long drive south to see the WUSA San Diego Spirit.
You know, we were just talking about that, and we haven't, but we're definitely going to be doing that.
Aguilar did make the hour-long drive west to the Home Depot Center to watch the WUSA doubleheader last Sunday, a WUSA festival event aimed at keeping the dormant league in the hearts and minds and maybe wallets of soccer families. It's all the WUSA could do without a business plan, without a list of cities to play in, without a date to resume play. About 7,100 fans attended the WUSA Festival, which, oddly enough, was the average game attendance during the league's 3 years. Festival organizers were hoping for better than that, though, not only last Sunday, but when the WUSA began. Scott French, who writes for Soccer America magazine, says the Women's Pro Soccer League was built on hopes and dreams that couldn't possibly come true.
In one of the first teleconferences they had with the media, they predicted 2.0 television ratings. I mean, that was absurd. There was no way they were ever going to get 2.0s. They came in with this idea they were going to get all this money from sponsors, that everyone was going to want to sign on because of this 99 team, and because this 99 team was so special that everyone loved them. And they weren't thinking of it in terms of businesses. They were thinking too much with their hearts and not enough with their heads.
Which is what doomed just about every upstart sports league over the past 60 years, with few exceptions. But unlike the USFL or the World Hockey Association, the WUSA has a chance, a slim one, but a chance to revive itself and find a profitable niche in the sports marketplace.
Thanks for coming, you guys.
While the second game of the soccer doubleheader was going on, the players from the first game stayed along the sidelines, reaching into the stands to sign soccer balls or T-shirts for dozens of kids, mostly girls, who crowded along the railing. Ruby Cisneros held a shirt covered with autographs.
How many did you get?
Oh, I can't even count. Almost everybody.
Are you going to ever wash that shirt?
No. I hugged Abby Wamba, and I'm never taking a shower.
Mia Hamm is the most famous female soccer star in the country, but Abby Wambach is probably the best. She was the WUSA Rookie of the Year in 2002, then in 2003 the top scorer on the best team in a league that's now nearly dead. Nearly dead is not dead, but Abby Wambach concedes the WUSA might get only one more chance. She says for the good of the league, for the good of women's soccer, the players might have to forget about making money and concentrate instead on making history.
Maybe some of the players have to get other jobs. Maybe some of the other players have to coach, you know, do camps. But these are all things that I'm willing to do. I'm willing to sacrifice for, because that's how much I love this game, and that's how much I think that this league can succeed.
Wambach's faith is shared by dozens of players and by a few thousand fans who pledged money in addition to season ticket deposits to revive the WUSA. But to run a league, you need a business plan, which league officials say could be in place by the end of the month. The soccer faithful involved in reviving the WUSA, including former U.S. national coach and former WUSA Commissioner Tony DiCicco, will meet soon with more than 75 sports business executives. In that group, DiCicco hopes to find team owners or sponsors who will bring the WUSA back to life.
So are we saying a full season 2005 like we had 2003? I'm not sure that's realistic. It's something we're going to try for. If we can't do that, then we're going to have a 2005 season that's going to be a much more extensive festival season, maybe create a WUSA Cup, or, you know, so that the teams are much more active. The players are much more active, all building towards the full launch the following year.
But the scenario league officials swear you won't see is the end of the WUSA. They promise to play again, a promise not based on hopes and dreams like the first time, but instead on clear-eyed reality and cold, hard cash. For Only a Game, I'm Nick Roman in Carson, California. The party line in the National Basketball Association is that the league does not tolerate thuggish behavior, let alone criminal activity. In a new book entitled Out of Bounds, author Jeff Benedict suggests that violence and crime are built into the culture of the NBA. Jeff Benedict joins me now in the studio. Jeff, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
One of your previous books, Pros and Cons, documented the criminal acts of current and former NFL players. Was there a particular reason why you turned to the National Basketball Association, or are you just gradually working your way through all the games?
I thought I had written my last book about sports 6 years ago, but last year when Kobe Bryant was arrested on rape charges in Colorado, I was pretty compelled by the national reaction to those charges and the difficulty that a lot of people had squaring the image of the basketball star who sells a lot of products like McDonald's hamburgers with the image of someone who could have committed a heinous sex crime. And most people asked this question, why would someone who has all that Kobe Bryant has and has such a beautiful wife by his side rape somebody? It's a question that demonstrates a profound misunderstanding of what life is like in the NBA.
You looked specifically at players employed in the NBA during the 2001-2002 season, and I gather that when you began investigating how many of those players had criminal complaints filed against them, even you were shocked.
I was stunned. At the start of the project, we began by sending out about 150 documents requests under the Freedom of Information Act. Those were targeted at 94 police departments, over 30 courthouses, and roughly a dozen district attorney's offices around the United States. We got back over 12,000 pages of court transcripts, police files, affidavits, search warrants. We even ended up with some video surveillance tapes and forensic photographs from crime scenes. In the end, we had just a cache of records on these players. What it enabled us to do was to do a criminal background check on roughly half of the players in the NBA, and we found that 40% of them have a police record for a serious crime.
And could you extrapolate from that? Is there a figure in terms of the NBA as a whole?
I think the 40% figure is, as stunning as it is, it could even be a conservative number. And the reason I say that is because my research was limited to adult records. I had no access to juvenile records, and published reports have documented numerous players in the NBA that have juvenile records. Beyond that, I found 30 more players through a standard LexisNexis search, which looks only at published reports, New York Times, USA Today, found 30 more players through that method that had police records. Those players are not represented in the 40% statistic because I had a very stringent barrier. You could only get into this statistic if I got you through a random documents request through a police department, a sheriff's office, or a court.
Some of what you say in this book doesn't make a distinction between arrest and conviction. Numbers of these guys have been arrested for various things or charged with various things and then never convicted. Shouldn't that be a distinction that's made?
I think the distinction is made because the story in this book isn't the statistic that 40% of the players have a police record. The story here is why if you're an NBA player and you get charged with a serious crime, you either don't get convicted or even if you do get convicted, the sentences are so trivial, they're essentially meaningless. And as an example, the book opens with Reuben Patterson, who sexually assaults his nanny in his home on a night when Mrs. Patterson is in the hospital having surgery. He pleads guilty to a sex offense. He's forced to register as a sex offender in the state of Washington. He should have got, at a minimum, a one-year jail term. The judge agreed to suspend it to a 30-day sentence, and then, At the lawyer's request, the judge allowed him to serve those 30 days in his home during the offseason. The story of Out of Bounds isn't that players in the NBA are more likely to get arrested. It's that players in the NBA get an entirely different standard of justice when they get accused, and the reason for that has a lot to do with their wealth, their fame, and their connections.
Of course, the counterargument is that sometimes guys who are wealthy and famous get arrested and are victims just because they're wealthy and famous.
No question about it. And if you look at the 22 felony rape complaints that I found for this book, and that's the area where it most surfaces, this allegation that athletes are targets. It's in the area of sex crimes, and the suggestion is women who accuse them are targeting them for money and fame. Of the 22 felony rape complaints that I found, only two were found to be fallacious claims. In other words, fabricated by women who had targeted the athlete. The other 20 cases were not like that. And I think we've got to keep in mind, particularly when it's a rape case against an athlete, there's a big difference between an accuser who goes and hires a civil attorney and files a lawsuit for money and a woman who goes to a hospital and submits to a rape kit exam and then goes to the police and files criminal charges where there is no money at the end of that. And this book is about the criminal charges, not the civil lawsuits.
You contend that, quote, the environment and the culture of the NBA, quote, encourage criminal behavior. To what extent would that still be the case if, say, teams agreed not to draft or employ any player who had been convicted of a crime?
That would certainly minimize it. I mean, one of the themes in Out of Bounds is that the colleges have some culpability here. By giving scholarships to players with a criminal history or by allowing players in college who commit crimes to remain on scholarship, that contributes to this problem of players getting into the pro ranks and then committing more serious crimes. But even if you eliminated that, you're still going to have the problem that exists in the NBA, which is a culture where they're the youngest professional league in sports right now. They're the richest professional league in sports right now. So you have wealth, youth, and these incredible sums of free time where these players have nothing to do. And what a lot of them will use that time up for, when they're on the road in particular, is in strip clubs, new dancing facilities, linking up with groupies in hotels, none of which is necessarily illegal. But when they spend that much time with women who are servicing them in that way, what happens is they get a very warped perception of women and a very skewed, distorted view of what's appropriate behavior. They lose sight of the line. And so when they encounter a woman that says no, they break the law often. And
because they don't believe it. Couldn't be true.
Not only couldn't be true, but they've never experienced it. And I did a whole chapter in the book that's not about crime, but it's about this environment. It's built around the Gold Club case where this infamous sex club in Atlanta was shut down in a racketeering scandal. But the important thing was NBA players got swept up in that, Bill. And Patrick Ewing testified at that trial, and under oath, he talked about going to this new dancing facility time after time and having women come in and perform all kinds of illegal sex acts on him for cash. And one of the players compared this to being as routine as going shopping. When you get to that point, I think you've got a pretty distorted view of women.
You suggest in the book that the league won't do anything to encourage or promote more responsible behavior among players as long as the league is profitable, or is that interpretation of what you've written too pessimistic on my part?
Well, I think we can only look at the record, Bill, and the record is that just in the last couple of years, Ruben Patterson has been convicted and registered as a sex offender for a serious and heinous assault on his nanny in his home. The NBA's response was a 10-game suspension. Glenn Robinson, one of the perennial all-stars in the league, was convicted by a jury last year of brutally assaulting a woman in her home and threatening to shoot her with a gun while there was a baby in the house. NBA's response, 3-game suspension. Jason Richardson, slam dunk champion, convicted by a jury, beating a woman, 3-game suspension. I think if you look at those suspensions and stack them up against the severity of these crimes, it leads you to no conclusion but that the NBA doesn't take this seriously.
At the end of Out of Bounds, you say the NBA is going to have to choose, quote, whether it wants to be perceived as a league of selfish, shameless thugs or return to the highly respected team sport that it once was. Does the NBA acknowledge the crisis that you allege in this book?
They probably won't acknowledge it publicly, but it doesn't take an expert in basketball or even an astute fan to realize how dramatically this game has changed. in the last 20 years. I mean, anybody who watched it, just go back to the Larry Bird, Magic Johnson era. There are incredible differences in terms of the way the game is played now and then. And I could care less, frankly, what the NBA does about it, how the games are played. But I think that having done the book and done interviews with countless people from all walks of life, there was a common theme that ran through the end of each interview, and which is, I don't watch the NBA anymore because I'm so turned off by this kind of behavior.
Jeff Benedict is the author of Out of Bounds, Inside the NBA's Culture of Rape, Violence, and Crime, published by HarperCollins. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the ongoing internationalization and rejuvenation of women's golf. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
You'll be glad to learn that it's National Schadenfreude Day once again, because news out of Durham and Los Angeles is that Mike Krzyzewski is the top candidate to coach the Lakers. And if that happens, not one but two basketball dynasties will crumble, don't you think?
Well, the basketball dynasty in Los Angeles that he's preparing to lead is already crumbling, whether or not they get him. I don't understand this move at all. Mike Krzyzewski has had a number of professional jobs laid at his feet every offseason since about 1996. Why he would decide to sign aboard the death ship in L.A., with Shaquille O'Neal leaving town and Kobe Bryant possibly going to jail, is anybody's guess.
You don't buy my explanation that he's a Randy Newman fan.
I don't buy that at all. And he doesn't surf. I know that. Mikey don't surf.
Tracy McGrady became a Houston Rocket this week. On Wednesday, hundreds of fans loudly welcomed him to his new home. I wonder if Yao Ming was among them.
I'm sure he was. Yao Ming will become a much better player with Tracy McGrady next to him, with a tall, versatile person who can really score. I think this is a terrific move for the Rockets. Tracy McGrady is 25 years old. And oddly enough, he's the fourth defending scoring champion in the NBA to be dealt away, but the first one since Bob McAdoo got traded to the Knicks in 1976. Tracy McGrady is already a better player than Bob McAdoo.
McGrady's former employer has already announced that the Orlando Magic will be better off without him. Has he got a case?
No, because the Orlando Magic always says this. The Orlando Magic said they would be better off without Shaquille O'Neal because they had Penny Hardaway. The Orlando Magic said they'd be better off without Penny Hardaway because they had John Amici. Now they're saying they're going to be better off without Tracy McGrady because they got Steve Francis. The Orlando Magic are stuck in the mud, and Steve Francis isn't going to help them get out of it anytime soon.
Eric Dampier, late of the Warriors, opted for free agency on Wednesday, so he's available. One of an unusually large number of fairly attractive parts that GMs trying to assemble various puzzles may be considering, or so say the experts. Are they right about that unusual number?
I think there are more of them that would pique interest in the normal offseason, but there are very few of them that are going to turn the team around. Sharif Abdul-Rahim from the Blazers is a nice player. Antoine Walker is an interesting name out there if you happen to have an established franchise already. Otherwise, you've got a lot of has-beens, almosts, and never was. I mean, Larry Hughes from the Wizards will get you 40 points in one game and three the next. Andrew LeClerc, Othello Harrington, Kerry Kittles, these are all spare parts. Abdul-Rahim is probably the prize of the bunch.
Mock 2005
no.
NBA draft.
Get away.
Became available 2 days after last week's 2004 honest-to-goodness NBA draft. Can you give us a hoop scoop regarding next year's bounce ball conscription, oh hardwood Swami?
Nemanja Aleksandrov, the 17-year-old Serbian seven-footer. I'm telling you, remember that name, Nemanja Aleksandrov.
On Monday, Billy Hunter, the head of the NBA Players Association, said the league may be headed toward a work stoppage a year from now. Do you think the NHL is happy or distressed to have their headlines stolen once again by the NBA?
Well, the only problem with this, of course, is if the NBA and the NHL both go out, the NFL is going to be mightily tempted to play a 29-game season.
On Tuesday night, Arizona ace Randy Johnson notched his 4,000th strikeout and thus became only the fourth pitcher to have ever done that. Johnson's in the news again after the covetous old sinner who runs the Yankees expressed interest in acquiring him.
This is a report and not a commentary, by the way. Should George Steinbrenner face tampering fines for all this?
Covetous old sinner? Isn't that's a Christmas carol, right? That's Scrooge, I believe.
I believe you're right.
Does he employ his players in the dark satanic mills in the Bronx? Yeah, George ran his mouth on the radio. He said, God, who wouldn't love to have Randy Johnson? He's a dominator. We'd love to get him. The commissioner's office finds this sort of thing, my dear young man, this simply is not done. So he'll have to fork over maybe $100 or something for saying the wrong thing on the radio. It's a pretty small penalty considering what the FCC's handing out these days.
Here's more evidence that the New York Mets are falling apart, Charlie. At Sunday night's game, the Mets weren't all wearing the same uniform, and at least one of them didn't notice. Any idea what the fines will be on this one?
Certainly there are rules against this sort of thing.
You have to all wear
Tom
the
Wilson,
same
who's a catcher, and a reliever named Jose Parra had to wear different jerseys from their teammates because the Mets didn't bring along the right ones. I don't think you can fine the players. I mean, although I am a little bit worried about catcher Tom Wilson not realizing that he was dressed differently from everyone else in the field.
About a year ago, the concept of Moneyball was all the rage. You may recall this, I'm sure you do, with Oakland A's general manager Billy Beane, the poster boy for the cause. But there's been an increasing amount of criticism of what many feel is an overly conservative and essentially stats-driven approach to baseball. Are you one of the people who accepts that view?
Now, it being National Schadenfreude Day, I'm very happy that the world's smartest humans among the teenage general managers are realizing that it's a little bit harder to run a baseball team than they think it is. The Red Sox are struggling because they adamantly refuse to bunt and refuse to give up outs. Oakland's going to find out how well Moneyball works if one of your aces, Tim Hudson, is out for a while. Neither team is in first place. Oakland is a half game behind the Texas Rangers, who I don't expect to last. Boston, having been swept in a three-game set by the Yankees this week, is now officially playing for the wild card.
Smarty Jones failed to win the Triple Crown, as we all know, but the mania surrounding the horse apparently lives on.
Smarty mania.
Yeah, Smarty everything.
Yeah, apparently, the name Smarty and the name Jones in various permutations has become an inspiration to people naming horses. So now, since May 14th, which is the day before the Smarty Jones won the Preakness and put itself in a position to win the Triple Crown, eight names have been registered by the Jockey Club. These include Sleepy Jones, Smarty Me, Like Smarty, Smarty Who, Smarty D, Smarty Joe, and Smarty Brown. Not to be confused with pop group Davy Dozy Beaky Mick and Tish.
No problem there. Finally, Charlie, a gunman in Monterrey, Mexico, found early this week that he should have been more careful about choosing which unarmed man to fire upon.
If you're going to shoot at the 98th ranked light heavyweight in the world, don't miss. Arturo the Graduate Rivera took it upon himself to fight back with his fist, and the attacker was treated in the hospital for head injuries, and it's a remarkably bad shot in the bargain.
Charlie, the Marquette graduate, Pierce, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
When rain suspended play at Wimbledon yesterday, defending champion Roger Federer held a 2-sets-to-none edge over Sebastian Grosjean, and Federer was leading in the third set, 4-3. Andy Roddick led Mario Ančić by a set and was leading 4-3 in the second set. In the women's final, which will transpire today if the weather cooperates, Serena Williams will face Maria Sharapova. The Tuesday through Thursday cavalcade of errors and extra innings when the Yankees hosted the Red Sox in New York this week notwithstanding, for much of the rest of the world, the biggest current sports story involves Euro 2004, the ongoing European Soccer Championships in Portugal. Some of the subplots have followed historical precedent. After early disappointments, the head coaches of the teams representing Germany, Italy, and Spain either resigned or were sacked. Rudi Völler, the ex-coach in Germany, manfully concluded that the team would be better off with a leader who was, quote, untarnished. There has been speculation that the German who's currently coaching the Greek team, Otto Rehagel, might succeed Mr. Völler unless he takes up a grateful government's offer and becomes a Greek citizen. Inaki Saez, the coach of the Spanish team, had intended to carry on, but after what was termed, quote, a lynching in the Spanish press, he thought perhaps not. Individuals who failed on the field have also taken a beating in the papers. Englishman David Beckham plays his club soccer in Spain. When he badly missed a penalty kick and plunged England into dismay, newspapers in Singapore featured headlines such as "Blow It Like Beckham" and "Footballer, Pop Star, Philanderer, Flop, The Short History of David Beckham." Pro basketball fans will point out that the addition of Yao Ming to the NBA has made that league a big deal in China, but even David Stern's ambitious international marketing efforts are unlikely to create a basketball buzz as loud and sustained as the excitement caused by soccer's Euro Cup or World Cup extravaganzas around the world. Rooting for your Chinese countrymen in Houston is one thing, but come on, outrage in Singapore over the performance of an Englishman who makes his living in Spain? Portugal's progress to the final ensures a festive 4th of July for the championship game. The presence of Greece gives every underdog supporter in the world a rooting interest. But my favorite anecdote to have come out of Euro 2004 comes from an English journalist who reports that every time he's asked a police officer or a cab driver in Lisbon for directions, the answer has been, "Oh, follow me, I'll take you there." I wonder how often that's happened to a Yankee fan in Boston or a Red Sox fan in New York. When play began Thursday in the U.S. Women's Open Golf Championship in South Hadley, Massachusetts, there were three Kims, six Lees, four Parks, and a Pock in the field. At her press conference on Tuesday afternoon, Grace Park, who presently stands at number two on the LPGA money list, said she'd heard that all told there were 30 Koreans playing in the Open. She was asked if the large number of golfers from countries other than the U.S. in the Open and at the top of the LPGA money list suggested anything about the landscape of women's golf.
It's not that people from other countries are working harder. I think golf is becoming more global than it ever was. And I think we're fortunate to have, you know, the best players from all over the world. And we should be thankful for that. It's good for the tour, it's good for just the game in general.
That is not only Grace Park's opinion, but the party line of the Ladies Professional Golf Association. LPGA Commissioner Ty Votaw, on hand for Tuesday's practice rounds at the Open, had this to say when I asked him if the growing number and greater success of foreign players explained the increasing popularity of the tour.
Well, that's the first way that type of question's been asked to me. It's usually the other way around in terms of why do you think that not having an American player has hurt, but the exact opposite has been the case. I think that certainly where you see these attendance and viewership and .com participant increases in an environment where our international scope has grown in the manner in which it has, over 90 players from 24 different countries, would suggest that the international diversity has contributed to our fan growth, and we see that continuing.
A quick look at the list of top money winners on the LPGA Tour indicates the origin and the pragmatism of Commissioner Votaw's perspective. Eight of the top 10 leaders come from countries other than the U.S. Four of them are Korean.
Certainly, I think you have to point to the success of Sehri Pak and Grace Park and Miyun Kim from Korea specifically. Our largest television rights fees come from Korea outside the United States. Our largest merchandising of LPGA logoed merchandise revenues come from Korea.
And they don't even have their names on the back.
They don't even have their names on the back. It's a remarkable fact, and I'd like there to be more countries where women's golf is more popular than their male counterparts. But at the end of the day, we're taking every country one country at a time in that regard, and certainly Asia has been a huge growth opportunity for us.
It's a growth opportunity which seems to be in no danger of shrinking, at least in terms of the primary ingredient, a continuing stream of ambitious and accomplished young and very young players who understand early that their goal in life is golf excellence. Betsy King, who joined the LPGA Tour in 1977 after graduating from Furman University and gained admittance to the LPGA Hall of Fame 9 years ago, wonders whether such an early and complete commitment to the game is always such a good plan. I asked her if that meant she thought some of today's best players might be better off going to college before they turned pro.
College, get out of high school. I mean, you know, you have Michelle Wiese, 14. I played with a 15-year-old today. And
Who was that?
In B Park. I'm another Korean. You know, her family moved to the United States 3 years ago so she could work on her golf game. You know, there aren't too many American families that, you know, make sacrifices like that just to develop somebody in a sport. But I think the cultures in some of the other countries, it's the whole family gets behind the daughter, and from the time she's 5 years old, the whole point is to get her onto the LPGA tour. And I don't know if that's necessarily good, but that's what's been happening.
Whether or not early intense concentration on golf has been good for the young and very young players as people, it has certainly been good for their golf games and for the game's bottom line. Commissioner Votaw maintains that attendance at tournaments and TV viewership have experienced double-digit increases over the past couple of years, and he says the tour is set to benefit from the next wave of young champions, and that guessing where they'll come from is part of the suspense and the fun.
We've had, you know, domination from Sweden. We've had domination from Australia. We've had domination now the past couple of years from Korea. I think that is going to continue. What we're looking at is what's the next beachhead? What's the next Korea? Is it Mexico with Lorena Ochoa? Is it the Philippines with Jenny Rosales? Is it China, where we haven't had a player on the LPGA Tour, but we've had a number come through our Q school unsuccessfully, and we see that continuing to happen with perhaps more and more success.
On the driving range at the Orchards, the site of this year's Women's Open, Hee-Won Han whacked irons beside NB Park, and Lee Ying-Yi practiced chip shots while Linda Ishii looked on. But that doesn't mean the biggest names among the U.S. golfers are absent. Julie Inkster is here, as are Meg Mallon, Kelly Keeney, and Lori Kane, as well as the aforementioned Hall of Famer Betsy King. And even King acknowledges that the presence of all the international players has enabled the LPGA to invent an identity and an itinerary very different from what the PGA has developed.
Yeah, I'd like to see us with a few more events, but I think the international part of it, the advantage is, you know, that our number one foreign market right now is Korea. I mean, we're more popular in Korea than the PGA Tour, and I know we've been more popular in Japan than the PGA Tour, and so in that sense, we have much more of an international market maybe to draw upon, and now we play two tournaments in Europe, we play in Japan, we play in Korea, so we really are becoming the world tour.
The changing geography of the LPGA Tour notwithstanding, Commissioner Votaw points out that last year's U.S. Open was won by Hillary Lunke of the Edina, Minnesota Lunkies, a Stanford graduate with a master's degree in sociology. The commissioner is not worried that the day of the U.S. female golfer has passed.
The death of the American women golfer has been greatly exaggerated because no country has more players in the top 50 than the United States. And I think that's going to continue to be the case going forward, but we'll always have our arms open to a worldwide audience and the best players in the world to come play our tour.
Play begins today with 23-year-old Jennifer Rosales of the Philippines in the lead at 5 under par. Kim Saiki and Candy Kung are one stroke back at 138. Annika Sorenstam is at 139. 14-year-old Michelle Wee is at 1 under par, 4 strokes behind the leader. Grace Park is 3 over par at 145. At 153, Betsy King did not make the cut. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out Lance's Wheels. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 14-year-old golfer Michelle Wee, who was asked if her daddy, also her caddy, advised her to lay up short of the water on the ninth hole during her Tuesday practice round at this week's U.S. Women's Open.
No, not really. I mean, I don't really listen to my dad anymore on the golf course.
Gee, a teenager who doesn't listen to her dad. Remarkable. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.